We'll get started with the hearing. Welcome, Mr. Nordstrom, to the Judiciary Committee. Today is Tuesday, the 15th of February, 2005. It's now about 20 minutes till the hour of 9 a.m. We have our continuing our overview of the Department of Law, and we heard from Ms. Parks, and you are presenting now the remainder of the story. So if you'd put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear what you have to say.
My name is Scott Nordstrand. I'm the Acting Attorney General. Several days ago, I was... Oh, here we go. Here's some additional...
By the way, Senator Huggins and Senator Seekins are present. Senator French is flying in this morning. Senator Guest is absent. And Senator Terrio will be joining us.
I'm here today in my sort of former capacity as Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division. Dave Marcus has been named Acting Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division, but I didn't think it was fair to, on day three, to give the overview of the Civil Division, so I'll be doing that for you today. Let me begin by talking just an overview of what the Civil Division is, and I've got a little brochure here that might help. The Civil Division of the Department of Law is basically everything that isn't criminal in terms of the legal practice of the department. So if you open up to the middle here, this is a brochure we use for recruitment purposes, but it's kind of a handy guide to the organization of the department. You'll see at the top the Civil Division has got 10 different sections and subject matter sections. They include collections and support, which does child support work and collects judgments for the states, collects restitution for victims of crime. We have a commercial and fair business section, which does various commercial kinds of activities, legal advice to HFC and the Division of Corporations, alcohol beverage control, and they also have a section in there, the Consumer Protection Unit, that's very important. 3.5 lawyers there that do the consumer protection work for the state involving not just enforcement of consumer protection laws, but also antitrust laws. We have an environmental section that handles representation of DEC, you know, oil spill issues, any kind of environmental damage claims or problems. And the next section is actually one of the largest in the Civil Division. It's actually the largest. It's the Human Services section. This is our representation of the Department of Health and Human Services, and we have 19 lawyers in there that do nothing but child in need of aid work, child protection work, and that's the most important, the most important aspect of that section. And I'll get back to that in terms of the priorities that we have in the Civil Division and how important that is. Labor and State Affairs is, I refer to it, and I think they enjoy this, as my junkyard dog of the Civil Division. They do whatever anybody else doesn't do. Any agency that the kind of advice they need doesn't properly fit into one of these other categories, they take care of it. It may be elections. It may be procurement. Labor relations is another important aspect, advising the department administration about labor contracts with the various employee unions. Civil rights issues, they also defend all of the employment claims brought against the state. We have a lot of employment claims that are brought against the state, not just, could be a contract kind of a claim, breach of contract, you fired me and that wasn't fair and I want my job back or damages, or it could be a Human Rights Commission kind of claim. For discriminatory conduct, either in promotion or hiring or firing. They defend all of those. They do Homeland Security. They do Medicaid rate. It's, as I said, kind of the junkyard dog of the Civil Division. We have a Natural Resources section that does exactly what you might think, advising the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Fish and Game, Board of Fish, Board of Game. We have a section on oil and gas and mining, and they do exactly what it would sound like. They're the ones tasked with providing representation and negotiation of the stranded gas pipeline. They take care of all the tax and royalty issues that involve the state's interest in oil and gas in the state. And notably there, you might, there's a former Attorney General, Wilson Condon, who's the chief there, and former Attorney General, former Commissioner of Revenue, former Deputy Attorney General. And whenever I need some advice, it's an awfully good resource to have in the department, I have to tell you. We have a new section called Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy. That is, its role is to provide public input to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska on the various aspects of whether it be utility regulation, it might be, you know, it might be your trash rates in Fairbanks, it might be a gas pipeline in Kenai, but the role of the Attorney General, it was changed here to allow the Attorney General to sort of set the agenda for what's in the public interest. And so you might have a, you know, Joe Blow Trash Company come to the RCA and ask for a rate increase. Well, usually it's just, I mean, it's the trash company and it's the RCA, and there need to be someone saying what's in the public interest. And so we advocate and we'll evaluate what the arguments that are being made and say, that's fair, it isn't fair, it's a good idea, it isn't. And so that was a change that the governor instituted by moving that function actually out of the RCA. There was a kind of a funny conflict situation. I mean, it worked, but it had some issues, the governor felt, because within the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, there was this separate office that would advocate to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska in the public interest. And we just thought it made more sense to have an outside entity doing the advocating and someone directly responsible, the governor, in this case the Attorney General. Our torts and workers' compensation section is does exactly what it sounds like. We defend all of the tort claims brought against the state. On a rare occasion, if it's a really big case that would take more than one attorney's full time, we do send some of that work out. That's paid for by the Division of Risk Management. All the agencies pay a little fee to risk management to cover their tort claims, and they in turn pay for our attorneys that do that work, as well as the workers' compensation claims against the state. We defend all our own workers' compensation claims, and we're one of the largest employers in the state, of course, and as a result have some of the, you know, the most claims and have a significant interest. You know, Senator, we've been through a lot on reforming workers' comp and those issues, but one of the things that's often lost is the state is not only, and the administration are not only in the business of trying to find a good system for everybody, we're trying to find a good system for us as one of the largest employers in the state. And finally, we have a transportation and public facilities section representing DOT. It does a lot of what you might expect in terms of roads and eminent domain work, building roads and making that possible, lease work for public facilities, you know, going through the process, construction projects. They represent the airports and that whole the new concourse at the airport. Our lawyers supervise the construction, and there are obviously construction claims arising out of that, and they are the ones that handle those, along with a lot of other things. So that's, to give you a sense of the scope of the Civil Division, I mean, that's the sort of subject matter scope. There are 135 lawyers who work for the Civil Division now. That's up slightly, and I'll talk a little bit about the increases we had last year. 135 attorneys in five offices. The largest office is Anchorage. We have probably around 85 lawyers in Anchorage in the Brady Building in downtown Anchorage. We have about a dozen lawyers in Fairbanks, and in Juneau, 25 lawyers. In Bethel, we have two, and we just opened our first new office in some time. We have one lawyer we've just added to Nome to do child in need of aid work. The rural offices are there for purposes of the China work. We have two China lawyers in Bethel, and this person that we've added in Nome will be doing Nome and Kotzebue from Nome. In the past, we've had the benefit of, when we had a child in need of aid caseload that wasn't a full attorney caseload, the criminal division, which has offices, as you know, in 13 different cities spread around, would do that work for us. We've gotten to the point with Nome and Kotzebue where I think Susan had enough, and we were filling up one whole lawyer doing our work, and so it was time for the Civil Division to belly up and put their own lawyer out there, and that's what we've just done. And Let me talk just for a minute about the changes for FY05. I want to thank the legislature for the support that they gave the Civil Division in adding attorneys for the first time in the Civil Division in a very long time, and they were very much needed. We added three trial lawyers in the doing China work, child in need of aid work, primarily in Anchorage. And our goal was to try to get the caseload for China cases down. You know, we had some of the presentations, budget presentations we made last year showed that depending on where we were, we had caseloads for China lawyers of, 150 to 120, 110. Fairbanks was the most reasonable. It was down to about maybe 105. But, you know, the national standards for this are really not even achievable. I mean, the suggestions are 60, 70 cases a person, you know, kids to be watching out for. We're trying to get it down to 100, and that's our goal, and we're making progress. We also added an appeals lawyer to do China work because, you know, the day-to-day grind of doing child in need of aid work, it's almost like a criminal practice. It's in hearings, out of hearings, very short turnarounds. You've got to do things very quickly, a matter of 24 or 48 hours. You've got to find witnesses. You've got to get to court. It's not conducive to doing appeals. You can't, you know, and to do an appellate brief well, you have to have a block of time and sit down and think and write and, you know, and also try to be consistent with all the other appeals that we're doing. And so we had one China appeals lawyer who could basically handle the Anchorage caseload. But Fairbanks and Juneau and Bethel didn't have any help. And so they were on their own. They're writing their own briefs. And so what we did also is we managed to add one China appeals lawyer so we can bring in all those appeals together so the trial lawyers don't have to do the appeals for the most part. I mean, there's always a little bit of overflow. But basically we have appeals lawyers who can do that so they can concentrate on the day-to-day work. And the other thing we did was we added a labor relations attorney, a dedicated person who works with the Department of Administration on issues involving employment or the collective bargaining agreements. And we were concerned that the Department of Law was not engaged enough in advising the Department of Administration and their labor relations section about contract issues, and not just you know what contract we agree to ultimately and the legislature approves, but also just grievance arbitrations and day-to-day work of under these agreements and having good legal representation, legal advice for these folks. So we added an attorney there. We also added an Ethics Act attorney who works in the Attorney General's office, and we added this isn't technically in the Civil Division, but we added a legislation and regulation attorney for Dave Marcus. And I don't know, Senator Huggins, you may not know her yet, but you will come to know Deborah Baer, who who knows all about this kind of legislation and regulation and works very closely with the legislature. But we needed somebody to be backup because, you know, Deborah would go on vacation and we'd all look around and wonder, what do we do now? So we brought in Randy Ruaro, who is a staffer here in the legislature, to sort of learn at the feet of the master, and so that's what we're doing there.
If I could just interrupt you for a minute here, Mr. Nordstrand, I've got to run upstairs for just 1 minute to the Finance Committee, and I'll be right back, so we're going to recess here for about 5 minutes. We're back on the record.
Senator, I want to just take a couple of minutes here at the end. We sort of discussed a little bit about the Civil Division and how we've changed in the last year and added resources, but I want to take a few minutes and talk about some of the new initiatives that we've instituted and are considering instituting as well. One area that I'm particularly focused on is the ability of the government to collect the money that it's owed, and in emphasizing the collection section. And in that regard, I learned that The Department of Health and Human Services let me back up here.
If you have someone who is receiving
Medicaid benefits, and let's say they're in a traffic accident, and as a result, because they don't have their own health insurance or capability to pay for their own medical treatment, the state pays, and Medicaid pays. But at the same time, if there was someone responsible for that injury, the state has the right to go after that person, an insurance company or an individual, to get the money back that we paid to treat this person who was injured. And what that's called is a Medicaid lien. And it's much like a workers' compensation lien and other kinds of liens that health insurers have to get money back from those who have cost them money through their own negligence. Well, the Department of Health and Human Services has been contracting out this activity. So there'd be these claims that are available, and in fact the statute requires anybody who files a lawsuit where there might be some Medicaid money that's owed the state, they have to notify us. Now that's not always done, I have to tell you, and it's frustrating. But what was happening was there was a company that was taking a cut, so to speak, of whatever they collected and turning the rest of the money back over to the state. Now, Medicaid money is 60% federal money and 40% state money, so part of it would go back to the state and part would go back to the feds, depending on how much they got back. We figured out that the amount of money we were paying in their cut, their commission, so to speak, was $300,000 to $400,000 a year, and we're not convinced that they were very actively pursuing claims that could be made. They were basically just waiting for people to tell them that we've got this claim and a settlement comes in, they take the check. I mean, they were doing some more investigation work, but we didn't think it was as active as it could be. So what we did was we entered into an agreement now with Health and Social Services to take over that work. They give us an RSA this coming year for $400,000 to hire essentially two lawyers and a paralegal to do the work. That's about what they were paying this other agency to do it, and that other agency had all of, I think, one paralegal, and occasionally some legal support. But we're going to have a lot more beefy system, and we're also not going to be paying a commission. We're going to keep whatever we can get. And so far, we've already had some successes of just being more active, more aggressive, being unwilling to compromise our liens. And so that's one initiative we're doing that I think will actually make money for the state and for, bring money in through the Department of Law. That's one initiative that we have completed and have started the process for. Another initiative, and this has to do with, I've got a belief that what we can do best at the Department of Law and the management team is to enable our lawyers to do better work themselves. And that involves an investment in technology and management technology and legal research technology. In the last year and a half, we've implemented something called WestKM, which is short for knowledge management. And you probably know what Westlaw is, and it's a legal research service, web-based, where you can pull up the Alaska database for Alaska cases, and you could search for they call it a Boolean search, sovereign within so many words of immunity, and you'd pull up all the cases in Alaska about sovereign immunity. Well, what we haven't had at the Department of Law is an ability for our attorneys to use the work product of our other attorneys. So that one attorney in Bethel who's done a really good brief on some child in need of aid issue, that brief is sitting on their computer in Bethel or maybe on a server in Anchorage, but it's not available to the attorney in Juneau who might be doing that exact same issue. So we're not getting the best bang for our buck in terms of the work product. What WestKM has allowed us to do, and we're just getting this implemented, is we're going to take all of the best work product from the Department of Law, and it could be briefs, it'll be memos of advice, it'll be informal letters, informal opinions of the Attorney General, formal opinions of the Attorney General, and they're going to be put into it, and they are being put into a server that Westlaw or the West Publishing folks points a software package that they have at this server, and essentially what they do is turn our documents into West documents on Westlaw. So you pull up Westlaw at the Department of Law right now, and there'll be a database there that is Department of Law database. So I can search for sovereign within three words of immunity in our own documents and pull up, and it'll pull up, the brief that Susan Parks wrote 2 years ago, the brief that I wrote, you know, a year ago, and it'll show who wrote it, what it's about, when it was written, and here's the best part of all. If you look in a West document in a case online, every case that's cited in that case is highlighted. So you can click on it and it'll take you to that case. And you'll be able to see whether that case is good or bad law even. There's little flags that they put, a red flag if it's been overturned, a yellow flag if it's cautionary, and green flag if it's still good law. And in the document, so to speak, in a case, you can scroll down and you'll see if the cases they're relying upon in that conclusion are still good. We are going to be able to do this with our own documents. So we'll have a Supreme Court brief we turned in 3 years ago. It'll be in the database. We'll be able to pull it up, and West will have gone through, hyperlinked all of these cases, and made it possible for us to see if the cases we relied upon at a glance are still good law. And then you can take that whole document and use it again. So now, how did we do this? The way we did this was it canceled all the books, just about all the books. And it was a struggle. And a lot of people like books. When you're a lawyer, you like books. You like those, you know, the reporters, you like the statutes, you like the federal statutes, and you like having all that, but it's very expensive. So we took about $150,000 to $200,000 a year of expense, and we eliminated it by canceling the books, and we invested in this technology. So that's what we've done in terms of technology to enable our lawyers to do a better job. We're also asking in this calendar year, in this budget year for FY06, and Senator, we've talked a little bit about this, is a new case management system for the Department of Law, specifically for the Civil Division. Right now, we have no capability to do something as basic as a conflicts check on a new case. In other words, Joe Blow is suing the state for a tort claim in torts and workers' comp and wants $1 million for something. We can't find out whether or not Joe Blow is also the subject of a criminal case, or is in fact, you know, owes child support down in the collections and support section, or that he's a witness in this other case. In the basic kind of management tools that every law firm in this state has, I mean every law firm, because you can't get malpractice insurance without having conflict checking and case management capabilities. The Department of Law has no capability in the civil section to do that. We don't have the capability to pull up information on a case and say, okay, what's the attorney assigned to it? What's the complaint? What's the answer? What are the deadlines in the case? We have no calendaring system. Can you imagine that? No calendaring system other than a basic group-wise calendar that is not functional and not reliable for purposes. So attorney Joe Blow doesn't come to work today. He's got, okay, what was Joe supposed to do today? It may be on his calendar, it may be on a written calendar, it may not. We don't know. And so what we're going to do is we want to invest in technology that will allow us to know. So we're not going to be attorney-based anymore. We're going to be case-based. So we can pull up the case. All the deadlines in that case will be there. It'll say the attorney assigned. We'll be able to, if Joe Blow doesn't show up to work, pull up all of Joe Blow's deadlines and all of his cases and know immediately what needs to be done and why. And we'll have access to management information to manage lawyers better in terms of their billings, knowing what they're doing. Right now we have a billing system, as you know. We do bill out to the agencies and even to ourselves for our general fund cases. But all it is a narrative. It's, you know, you pull up 7.5 hours, did this, and it's billed against a client in a particular case. But that, you know, unless you want to spend all day long every day reading the narrative of 135 lawyers, it's basically useless information as a management tool. What we're going to do is get a billing system where we can identify activities, and we can say, okay, I 2 hours in court, you know, arguing a case, 2 hours researching a motion, and we'll identify activities, talking on the phone to the client, and then we'll be able to see what are our lawyers actually doing with their day. Is this guy on the phone all day long to the client? Well, that may mean the client's, you know, causing a problem here. We don't need them on the phone all day to the client. Or maybe it's a good thing. I don't know. But we'll actually have information. So that's, and let me just add one last part to that is, an element of this beyond case management, conflict checking, calendaring is document management. And this goes back kind of to the West KM issue, and that is, we don't have any document management system in the Department of Law so that we can pull up, we prepare an answer, we prepare a brief, where is it, who wrote it, where do we keep it, is it kept by case? Right now, if someone in the civil division works in torts, gets a complaint, some prisoner suit, personal injury suit or something, and they write an answer to that complaint, where they put it on our computer system is wherever they want to. That's where it's kept. And what they call it is whatever they want to call it. And so we're going to try to get a system, and there are, it's ready off the shelf. We're not going to create something new, and we'll have a document management system as well. So that's sort of the initiatives that I'm interested in from the Civil Division's point of view, and even as Acting Attorney General, is to build the technology that will allow our attorneys to do their job better. And let me just end with, Mr. Chairman, we've talked a little bit about this as well. I think one of the greatest challenges for the Civil Division and the Criminal Division, the Department as a whole, is recruitment and retention of attorneys. This is crucial. That is our product. Our people are what we are. I mean, that's true in all of government, but it's particularly true in the law firm. And we're the largest law firm in the state of Alaska, essentially. That's the way I look at it. We have 250 lawyers in the Department of Law. There are about 2,500 lawyers in the whole bar in Alaska. We're 10% of the entire bar. It's enormous. And in the Civil Division alone, in the last 2 years since I've become deputy, there are 135 lawyers. I've hired 50 attorneys. 50. That's been the turnover in Civil Division. And it isn't because, a bunch of people got fired or something. This is attrition. Some of it was new attorneys, and we talked about adding 5 or 6 new attorneys in the Civil Division last year. But it is simply turnover. I mean, I'm getting to the point now where I have people that I hired within the last 2 years that are leaving. I mean, I'm seeing my people leave. And you have to ask the question, why is that? And I think there's a couple of reasons. But primarily, it's pay. We have fallen behind. I'll give you an example. When I first started practicing law in the state in 1987, I went to work for a firm called Scheibel, Staley, DeLisio & Cook. And Grace Scheibel was a senior partner at the time, a Fairbanks and Anchorage firm. And I had been a law clerk for a couple of summers, and I, inertia being what it was, they offered me a job, and oh boy, I'm going to be an associate attorney. $37,000 a year. I remember it like it was yesterday, because it was so much money I couldn't believe it. And that's what I got paid. And I think, and I don't know the exact numbers, but the assistant attorneys general and DAs, assistant district attorneys back then, were not being paid a whole heck of a lot less at that time. I mean, it may not have been 37, that was a pretty good pay, but it was in that ballpark. And remember, we're talking about a time when you might come out of law school with $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 of student loans. Well, that was in 1987. Today, fast forward to where the state is today. Today, we start attorneys as attorney twos, which is you pass the bar, you've had 6 months of good work, and now you're an attorney two. So it's basically our starting salary, $50,000. That's the difference, But then compare that to the private sector. In the private sector, depending on the firm, some of the smaller Alaska firms may not pay quite this much, but, all of the outside firms, the Perkins Coies, the Davis Wrights, the Heller Ermans and all that, they're starting their associates at $80,000, $90,000 a year, easily, and some more. There's experience of $100,000, $150,000 a year in some of the big cities, but that's not the case here. So think about that difference. Now we're talking about the difference between $50,000 and at least $80,000. That's the difference. And then, if you combine that with the fact that the federal government pays their attorneys a lot more than we do, even I'm losing attorneys to the municipality of Anchorage. Now that really irritates me, for pay reasons. Now, so, and I know that it's part of a larger state pay issue. And I understand that, and everybody's on the pay chart, and you fit in a range and a step and all of that, and I understand that. But we are getting to the point where the turnover is affecting our ability to do the work. Look at the China lawyers, for example, the 19 China lawyers that we have in the Civil Division doing the work. I was talking to our chief. Well, we before last year, we had 16 China lawyers. Now we have 19, trying to bring that caseload down. But what has happened is, first of all, we we are constantly trying to backfill. We really only have 16 lawyers because we've got three vacancies and we're still trying to fill them. So we're doing better than last year because last year we would have had 13. Now we've got 16. We want to have 19. But who are these lawyers? Well, what we're finding out is out of those 16, half of them have been a China lawyer for less 2 years or less. And what that means is the other eight are spending a lot of their time training, helping, sitting second chair in trials, and we're losing productivity. So it's not, and part of, you know, the answer to, you know, what'd you do with all those lawyers we gave you last year is, we're trying. But at the same time, we're losing the capability to get the work done because of the turnover. And I think part of it is too, just the reality of tier one retirement, too. I mean, we're getting to that place where those folks are leaving. And, you know, there's really nothing you can say to them to make them stay. There's no point to it. They're not going to stay when they can retire and do as well as they can and go get a different job and do better. So if we just don't have the incentives to keep people from leaving. What they do is they come to the Department of Law, they can start an entry-level job, they get a job for a couple of years, they get some experience. Now they are a marketable item into a private law firm, to other governmental agencies, and they go. And the incentives that were built in the past of a pretty good paycheck, tier one retirement benefits and all of that, that incentivize people to stay for a long period of time, I don't think exists the way they did before. And I'm not saying that we can recreate those things. But so how have we responded to this? What we responded to, this is partially what you're looking at there. You've got a little brochure about, you know, we've created tools to actually recruit. We have a law clerk program that we've formalized as well, and we solicit law clerks to come and work for the department in the summertime, and honest to God, we actually pay them nothing because we don't have, there's no vehicle to pay the law clerks and actually make them state employees. So they come and they work for us for nothing for a summer, and we try to find if they're a good person, if they're a good attorney, and whether or not we can talk them into staying. We have limited capability of doing that because if you can imagine what they use this program to a large degree to leverage a better job somewhere else, for example, a Superior Court clerkship or something else. It's getting some of the good attorneys back to Alaska, and that's helpful. But and so we also started in the last 2 years recruitment tours. And Susan Parks and I, as the deputies, have spent in the last 2 years a week a year outside at law schools interviewing, mostly Northwest schools. This year we looked at some Colorado schools, trying to look at resource-based schools, Western-type schools, you know, with interests that are similar to Alaska, and we've done that as well. So I guess that's my greatest concern is enabling the lawyers with the technology to let them do their job more efficiently, get more bang for the buck out of the lawyers, and recruit and retain lawyers. That's the greatest challenge, I think, for the Civil Division and, frankly, for the Department of Law as a whole.
Thank you, Mr. Norrison. I have a question. You're talking about lawyers and being able to retain them and keep them. What do you charge DOT, for an example, for a lawyer that does work for them? I imagine there's an interagency charge. What is that?
The way our system works is we have a series of RSAs with all these various agencies. In fact, the Civil Division is funded about 60% by contracts with agencies to pay for lawyers. And what we charge is essentially a flat fee by lawyer. It changes every year. It's like $180,000 for a full-time lawyer. And what we do is we come up with an average cost of a lawyer that includes their leased space, their computer, their desk, their secretary, all the costs associated with that lawyer. Because in order for us to, you know, say we're going to add a new lawyer to do DOT work, we have to get the full cost. It's not like other areas of government. So we build all that in and come with a combined average cost, and we say, okay, you want one lawyer full-time work? It's $180,000 RSA. And we have a price for paralegals as well. And then the way we get the money over the course of the year is they've essentially committed in their budget to giving us up to $180,000. And then we bill them, and our current rate this year is $108 an hour for our lawyers. And that's That's for everybody. That's for DOT. I mean, that's what we charge ourselves in our own general fund cases, because we have to allocate it back to ourselves, too, to be fair, allocate the costs all around. And so the problem we have, and this really is frustrating, frankly, from a management point of view, is if, say, it's a DOT lawyer, and say DOT doesn't send over $180,000 worth of work, you know, $108 times whatever to get to $180,000, and we only bill them $150,000. Well, we're $30,000 short on the cost of that attorney, and it's got to come out of our general funds. So that's problem number one that can happen, is you just didn't have enough work. You guessed wrong in terms of the amount of work. The other bad thing that can happen is, what if they send over $250,000 worth of work for this lawyer? That's possible too. Well, they don't have any money in their budget to increase the RSA. So we expend $250,000 in costs, and sure, our costs may not increase dramatically over the price of a single attorney, but there are additional costs, and we have to eat that out of our general funds too. And so, in fact, I had a case, I think I was telling you about, Mr. Chairman, where we had a person in working in the transportation section who was a very capable commercial litigator, and we just hired, and we were very glad to get him. And there was a case in our labor and state affairs section, a general fund case, you know, that we pay for with our own money, that needed some help. And he was the perfect guy to do it. So we asked him to prepare a motion in this case, and he did a great job. But here's what happened to us financially when we do that. One, he's not billing DOT. So $108 an hour that he would normally be billing 7.5 hours a day, we're not getting from DOT. That's the first bad thing that happens to us. The second bad thing that happens to us is he's working in this case, in a Department of Administration case that's funded by general funds, our money. So he's billing $108 to our general funds. So we lose double. We actually, $216 an hour we're losing just because this guy is tasked to that RSA. And you can imagine what would happen if you have 120 of those contracts and 135 different lawyers, and trying to get to the right number at the end of the year, so you've got all the right amount of RSA money in, and you haven't spent any more of that 40% general funds that you fund the department on, and it all comes out even at the end of the year. Well, our admin director goes crazy sometimes. She has these estimates I get every month that says, okay, we're $100,000 over on general funds. We got to dial it back somehow. And anyway, that's the short course on our funding.
Senator Terrio?
Well, $108 an hour is a bargain. But talking about the cost, the competitiveness of the salaries that you can pay, a lot of those firms that are offering those salaries, they're expecting 160, 180, some 200 hours, billable hours. Not hours sitting at your desk, but billable hours. And you just talked about your employee 7.5 hours a day. These firms, they wouldn't, even if they billed every minute of their time, they wouldn't make their monthly target in those private sector law firms. So you're right, a lot of these young attorneys, they get the job offer and they've got the big student loan debt, but they get into these firms and they quickly find out that they have no life. You know, the firm consumes their life, and they get to a point where they've got to choose to either leave that firm so they can get married and have kids and have some time. So, you know, it is a bit of a balance. So I do understand and hearing more that in different areas we're not competitive with regards to salary, but there are things that balance that out. And I think most attorneys that get that first job, they figure out after a while they got to get a little balance in their life because they can't live that way.
Through the chair, Senator Terry, I think that's exactly true. My goal for civil division attorneys is 1,500 billable hours a year, and that's you know, when I was a private attorney, my minimum at my old law firm was 1,800. So there's 300 hour delta, and some firms certainly require 2,000 hours a year, and you get paid more based upon how you do in terms of that. But the reality is, that we still have to actually get the bodies in the door and keep them, regardless of the lifestyle difference. And that's what's frustrating. But you are correct.
But do you, Mr. Chairman, if I can?
Go ahead.
People that you're hiring, are they all the new attorneys that you've got through the clerkship and going out recruiting, or do you get some that have been in the law firms, they've had enough of that, they want to go to a regular work week and not have to work the weekends? And I'm not saying that your attorneys don't come in on weekends, because I know they do, but are you getting some people that have put in, you know, 5-10 years at a law firm and decide that that's not what they want to do the rest of their life?
Chair of Senator Terrio, I don't know if the 5-year people are doing it. I'm getting some of the 20-year people. But I got to tell you, a lot of it has to do with the Tier 1 retirement thing. You know, so they want to come back and, you know, and they're very qualified and they want to come back and work 4 or 5 years and, you know, pay back in their retirement money and get back into Tier 1 and all of that. So I get a lot of those. Most of the others are. And we get a few lifestyle change people, you know, midlife sort of, this is too much. But most of them are young people, for the most part.
Maybe it's the difference in division. I have a son who works in the criminal division. He doesn't work 37 and a half hour a week. He was in private practice for a while, and I think he probably works more hours in the criminal division than he did in private practice.
Chair, I think that's exactly correct, and I don't want to leave the impression that the civil division attorneys are working 7.5-hour days. That's simply not the case.
Right.
Now, are there attorneys that, you know, don't work as hard as others? Yeah, there are, but for the most part, our attorneys work much more than 7.5 hours a day. They work weekends. They come in. I mean, look at these attorneys that work here and dealing with the legislature and the legislative issues. They're here on the weekends. They're here nights. And, we have fairly liberal leave, but, you know, trying to get to use it, that's another matter altogether. And so they work very hard. And I have billings to show attorneys that are working 2,000, 2,200 hours a year. We have those attorneys that are working in the civil division.
So now let me go in a different area that we haven't talked about. What's the? I was in preparation for a hearing we have tomorrow. I was going through some disclosures that we're all required to do in terms of our ethics, and I noticed two people in the list that are commission members that work for the Office of Public Assistance, attorneys, and their disclosure says one of them 4 years, $1 million, another one 1 year, $250,000 in income from the state of Alaska. They're both attorneys for Office of Public Assistance.
Office of Public Advocacy?
Advocacy, I'm sorry, yeah, okay. Now, so Office of Public Advocacy is hiring these attorneys from the private sector?
Well, I'm not an expert on this, and of course the OPA is handled through the Department of Administration, but I know that they do on occasion hire outside counsel.
And they're paying $250,000 a year. You can't provide that?
Well, what we do, Senator, is we on occasion do hire outside counsel, but the Attorney General's office generally tries to do all its work in-house because, frankly, we can do it more efficiently and cheaper by, you know, charging ourselves the $108 an hour.
I'm just looking at it and saying, geez, you're charging Department of Transportation $108 an hour, $180,000 a year.
Right.
The Department of Administration is paying $250,000 a year for an attorney to work in the Office of Public Advocacy.
Well, I would be surprised, Senator, and you'd have to ask them, but I would be surprised if they're actually employees. I suspect they're contractors.
I know that.
Yeah.
But it's still $250,000 a year outgo versus $180,000 a year.
That's true.
$70,000 a year.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind when you're hiring outside counsel is just because you pay $250,000 doesn't mean you got the full value of that person's full-time effort for that year. I mean, when I was a practicing attorney, 3 years ago, I was, at my hourly rate of 2 1/4, I would shoot to have $350,000 a year in billings. So, the right. cost of $250 may be only 2/3 of that person's work for that year.
What I'm looking at is I'm saying, okay, I'm looking at overall state budget, not just Department of Law.
Right.
I'm saying, now, if I'm going to hire an attorney for, and I'm Office of Public Advocacy, I'm going to go see Scott. Because I can save $70,000 a year hiring one of his attorneys versus hiring this guy out here at $250,000 a year.
I really do think that OPA has made efforts in the last year or so to dial back some of those contracts. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but I understand yeah. that's what they're trying
to do. This was on an ethics. We all have to report certain things. And I just happened to run into that because these are two members of the Select Committee on Ethics. Mm-hmm. Two attorneys. $250,000 a year is one of them reported, if I'm correct. The other one, over 4 years, $1 million paid by Office of Public Advocacy. And I know that this was coming up, and you and I had talked earlier in the week about what you're paying or charging for an attorney. And I guess I'm wondering why agencies are hiring private attorneys on a regular basis. One of them for 4 years has billed $1 million.
Well, I can tell you, I don't know why they do it. I'm sure they have their reasons. Our approach to outside counsel is we only do it when we absolutely have to, when there's an expertise that they have. For example, the millions of dollars that we're hiring an outside counsel and experts associated with the stranded gas pipeline efforts. I mean, we have very capable people, but that specialized experience with those very technical issues, we have to go buy that experience. The other example is when we get a case that's just too big for us to handle, the Miller's Reach case. You remember the Miller's Reach fire? And it would just consume maybe two or three right. of our tort lawyers. So we contract that out and we pay the $200 an hour or whatever it takes to hire a lawyer to do that. But that is the worst alternative for us. And we try not to do that. And
I guess I'm just trying to figure out here, in terms of business that I understand, you got two trucks sitting here. They both seem to be equally as equipped, and one of them costs $108,000, and one of them costs $180,000. One of them costs $250,000. What am I getting for my value? Where's my value over here? Are these guys, generally speaking, that you understand, I guess, is this something that you couldn't provide, or do they have their own attorney staff in OPA? Or
yes, Senator, they have lots of their own staff. I mean, we're opposite OPA in many of these child in need of aid cases, and they provide conflict counsel in criminal cases. The same is true of the public defender. I mean, they're separate agencies right. with their own attorney staff. OPA does have non-attorneys who act as guardians ad litem and stuff, but they do have their own attorneys, and they could hire more if they wanted, I suppose.
Do they basically pay the same for an attorney that you do?
I would assume so, because we have these attorney classifications, attorney 1 through 6, but I don't know that for a fact.
Secretary?
Mr. Chairman, I think if you look into it, it's probably they have bid an hourly rate. It's probably a little bit lower than the state's hourly rate. And then what I suspect is they churn the hell out of the file, to tell you the truth. That's exactly what's going on. It's a ripoff. It's a can of worms that you wouldn't believe.
Well, so I'm trying to figure that out, because I was just going through all of the deals last night, just, and I said, I asked Brian, I said, Brian, look at this. Here's two guys that are getting $250,000 a year.
To represent clients that they haven't even met with. It's a mess. It's a disaster.
Well, and if I could, Senator, I would suggest that the chances that they bid the contract and are actually paying, and that they that anyone in state government is buying an outside counsel or an attorney for less than $108 an hour, I would very much doubt.
I can't hire one for that.
Well, however the hours are billed, but we hire outside counsel. I've got some idea of what you have to pay, right. And for the very good ones, we even Anchorage attorneys, we have to pay a couple $100 an hour. But
I can't buy one for $108 an hour, especially if they had the benefits package that we give to state employees. On top of that, I mean, it would cost a heck of a lot more. But I'm just wondering what in the world. I mean, if you're having problems retaining attorneys because of competitive payway rates. And you're charging interagency levels at $108 an hour. Just, I guess I wonder. And then I know, at least Ms. Parks' people world must work harder than yours. I'm just kidding. Or David's now. I'm sorry. I guess that amazes me. How do you come up with this $108 an hour rate?
What we do it sort of backwards. In a normal business, you figure out, how much you think is a fair market rate for your services, will the market bear. What we do is we take all of our costs, our attorneys cost this much, the lights cost this much, the buildings cost this much, you take it all, you add it up, you pool it all together, and then you divide. And you figure out how much an hour you have to charge to get enough money to both in terms of the expenditure of our general funds and in obtaining these RSAs to make it all come out even at the end of the year. We're a non-profit organization. We're designed to charge as much as it costs.
Now, when DOT rents a car to the Department of Public Safety, they don't do it on their cost basis. They're rolling a profit into their system.
Well, we have a few cars from them, too. I wonder if they're gouging us.
Well, based on what the private market would charge you, they are.
That's how we do it. It's just designed to recover our costs, and so every year we do a recalculation of our costs increase, and so we have to raise our rates this much. And we're not designed to, there are other ways that this could be done instead of having this game of figuring out how it will come out even at the end of the year. I understand from our admin director, and I'm not an expert on this, but other agencies have pools of money, sort of a working capital. So you'd have a little in reserve. So if you got it, if you could run it like a business. In other words, if you bring in the income from your RSAs and your contracts, essentially, you use your general funds to expend. If you're a little bit off at the end of the year in terms of how it comes out, you adjust your rate next year to refill your capital fund, and that way you don't have to worry, essentially. I mean, my admin director at the end of the year can be a basket case because, we're $300,000 off one way or the other because someone didn't bill as many hours in DOT as we did in Labor and State Affairs. So there are alternative models, I think, and I think they actually do that in some of these, transportation pools.
I have reserve accounts, I'm wondering, in that regard, why the Department of Law hasn't done that?
Well, it requires capitalization. Capitalization means you need to have a couple of million dollars put in the pot to start the thing, and so.
Why, in your estimation, is there no case management system in the Department of Law and no document management system in the Department of Law? How long have these things been around, and how long has this been ignored?
Well, obviously, case management and conflict checking and calendaring, I've had it as long as I've practiced law, since 1987 when I started full-time practice of law. I've never been in a law firm that didn't have some rudimentary system like that. As I said, you can't get malpractice insurance in the private sector unless you have that. Document management technology is certainly newer, but clearly every significant law firm in the state of Alaska has document management technology of some kind now. The department just simply has never been able to get the funds or has been motivated to fix what, some might not think it's broken. I mean, if you come from the outside world, the private sector law firms, and you come in and you look at this and you say, my gosh, how are you doing this? This is nuts. You don't even have a calendar? How can you not have a calendar by case? But if you're in the system, and you never had a calendar.
Don't know it's broke.
Huh? You don't know it's broke. And that's, I think, part of it. I mean, I have people every year. This is, it's so frustrating. I get this request every year for new calendars. And everybody in the civil division goes around and they fill in a catalog, the little handwritten calendars, and then they write which one they want. And I'll get this huge list, and it'll be like $4,000 worth of paper calendars. And we do have this electronic group-wise sort of, you know, Outlook kind of system that works a little bit, at least for what we're trying to do. But I say, why are we buying all these paper calendars? I mean, that's not how we ought to be managing the Department of Law. But it's just the way it's always been done. And so my goal is to just push the thing forward, regardless, because it's too dangerous, frankly. And as we grow, 250 lawyers, I mean, the criminal system, or the criminal division, to their credit, does have a case management system. It's a proprietary case management system called CRIMES that they've had put in. It does much of what they need to do. They don't have document management, but the civil division has nothing.
How long has the criminal division had their system?
It's been since 1995. So 9 years, 10 years, and all the while the civil division has none.
Other questions? Well, we appreciate the overview. I'll tell you, it raised some questions in my mind that we'll have to take a look at as time goes along, but just interesting to me that we seem to have budget to be able to, in the Department of Administration, to hire outside private attorneys on a regular basis, but we're struggling to hire good attorneys in the Department of Law internally.
Just to complete that thought, as you think going forward about the cost of outside counsel, just remember that the real comparison is probably that $180,000 versus $350,000, because that's the, you know, if you want to get 1,500 good hours out of a lawyer of good legal work, that's what we can get for $180,000 or thereabouts. You take 1,500 times $150 an hour or $175, that's what it costs in the outside world to get that same deal. It may not be, you know, so it may not be $250,000, it may be $400,000. I mean, we have attorneys that we pay in specialized areas, you know, very experienced lawyers, $225,000 an hour. The Department of Law pays. So it depends on the rate and depends on the amount of work. So you got to compare apples to apples here, too. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Well, if there are no further questions, I guess, Mr. Marcus, do you have any opening remarks on your career as the head of the Civil Division?
I'm going to be looking for a new wardrobe.
New wardrobe. But congratulations, by the way. With that, this committee is adjourned.